This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
It's a gamut of personal finance topics with Money Talk. With sources like Kiplinger's and Money magazines, you'll hear articles for a broad spectrum of audiences about investing, retirement, savings, taxes, and family finance on Money Talk, coming up next on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Money Talk, and I'm your reader, Brooke Heiler, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I will be reading from Forbes, copyright 2025, the October-November issue. I'm going to start with an article called Brain Man, and this one is by Amy Feldman. Harriet Tabuteau combined a Yale medical degree with 2 decades in finance to start biotech firm Axsome. Now, its success with drugs for neurological disorders has made the Haiti-born immigrant a new billionaire. When Harriet Tabuteau started a drug development company in 2012, he decided to do so differently. First, he'd focus on brain disorders, treatments for which are notoriously difficult to develop and whose efficacy can be hard to prove. And he'd be both CEO and the scientific founder, bringing to bear his decades of experience investing in biotech startups and his medical training. But he'd take no venture capital, self-funding with help from friends and family. If you do things exactly the way as everyone else, you're going to have the same outcome as everybody else. And we wanted to have outcomes that stand apart, Tabuteau, 57, says during his first ever interview with a reporter about his company, Axsome Therapeutics. Named for 2 parts of a nerve cell, the axon and the soma, Axsome has come a long way from its beginnings in a windowless 3-desk office in New York's Rockefeller Center, affectionately remembered as, quote, the broom closet. Today, it has 3 drugs on the market and 5 in the pipeline, with the potential to help the estimated 150 million Americans suffering from conditions like depression, ADHD, or Alzheimer's disease. Revenue for the 12 months ended in June, reaching $495 million, up 70% from the same period in 2024. Axsome is not yet profitable, booking a net loss of $247 million in that time. The company trades on the NASDAQ with a market cap of $6.1 billion. Tabuteau is a billionaire thanks to his 15% stake in it, plus options. He figures Axsome could hit $16.5 billion in peak sales from its current drug portfolio, which would put it among the top 25 drug companies by revenue today. That's assuming all goes to plan, most particularly getting 5 new drugs through the FDA between now and 2028. It's a big ask. Only about 25% of drugs do well enough in phase 3 trials to move forward in the FDA process. Tabuteau was born in Haiti, where his birth mother struggled to raise him and his sister. He recalls experiencing neglect of all kinds, quote, physical, nutritional, emotional, but it taught me resilience, he says now. At age 9, he moved with his dad and adoptive mom to Manhattan's Upper East Side. Degrees in molecular biology and biochemistry from Wesleyan led him to Yale School of Medicine, where he plans to become a neurosurgeon. But he was so unsettled by the transparent unhappiness of his physician professors that he opted against a neurosurgery residency in favor of a job at Goldman Sachs Healthcare Investment Banking Group. That was the start of a nearly 2-decade career in finance that included stints at Bank of America Securities and hedge fund HealthCo SAC Capital, as well as managing his own funds. From his perch on Wall Street, he watched thousands of early-stage biotech succeed and fail, and began to develop his own theories about what worked and why. While most biotechs focus on just one drug, he realized that building a portfolio would cut the risk of a flop. To keep costs low, he shunned the industry's practice of outsourcing clinical trials, betting he could do it cheaper and with greater chance of success in-house. A Phase 3 trial could easily cost $50 million. Tabutu could do it for 30% to 50% less. "We got a lot of pushback," he says, as investors didn't believe he could run so many trials on such a low budget. Working on multiple drugs helped. When one trial ended, his researchers would immediately begin working on the next. Hedging his bets was wise. After going public in 2015, Axsome struggled, not unusual for an early-stage biotech, as drugs can take 10 years to get from idea to market. And while Axsome trials were cheaper, they were not cheap. The company's stock puttered along under $10 for years, its market cap dipping below $100 million after an early drug for pain flunked its clinical trial. "Nobody believed in Axsome years ago, and I think there's still a lot of unbelievers," says Axsome Chief Financial Officer Nick Pizzi. "It's a show-me story." Axsome's prospects skyrocketed with its first big drug, Auvelity. When the treatment for major depressive disorder gained FDA approval in August of 2022, shares popped 65% in a week, valuing the company at $3 billion. The drug combines two existing medications for a treatment that can begin to work in just 1 week, compared to 6 or 8 weeks for serotonin-based antidepressants, a huge advantage. To launch it, Axsome started with 165 sales reps, less than half of what is typical. But it paired those reps with software that could identify which docs were likely to be receptive to its products and to determine whether they'd prefer email, a phone call, or a face-to-face meeting. Auvelity is now on track to do $500 million in sales this year, and analysts figure the drug should become a blockbuster, industry parlance for a medication with more than $1 billion in revenue. Earlier this year, the company resolved patent litigation that will keep copycats off the market until at least 2038, a big win. Tabutu's finance expertise also paid off. In 2022, Axsome acquired a drug called Sunosi, which treats excessive daytime sleepiness in people with narcolepsy or sleep apnea. After pulling together a deal to buy it for $53 million plus single-digit royalties, in just 2 weeks over Christmas in 2021, Axsome was able to more than recoup its money when Tabutu sold the European, Middle Eastern, and North African rights to the drug for $66 million, plus milestones and royalties, less than a year later. Sunosi's revenue is now over $100 million annually. "It was a very shrewd financial transaction," says Muzaho analyst Greg Suvanevich. Shares have kept climbing, shooting up 35% over the past year to a recent $122, outperforming the NASDAQ Biotech Index, which is up just 1% over the same period. The next treatment to watch, a drug to treat the agitation that often accompanies Alzheimer's disease. Antipsychotic medications, currently the only treatment available, have serious risks, including death. Axsome's drug avoids those side effects, but has reported mixed results in Phase 3 clinical trials. Axsome plans to file for approval before the end of September. It's possible the FDA may not greenlight it, but analysts expect the need for an alternative to antipsychotics makes approval likely. It's core to Tabutu's plans to get to $16.5 billion. He projects $1 billion to $3 billion in sales for Auvelity, and $1.5 billion to $3 billion from the Alzheimer's agitation drug annually at their peak. "There's so much ahead of us right now in terms of the pipeline and the number of patients we're able to address," he says. "We might be a small company in terms of size, but we're not a small company in terms of fundamentals or in terms of ambition." There's a final thought quote here at the end of the article. "The rewards for biotechnology are tremendous. To solve disease, eliminate poverty, age gracefully. It sounds so much cooler than Facebook." And this is a quote by George M. Church. There's a couple small articles along with this one I just read. I'll read those to you now. This one is How to Play It by John D. Markman. With medicine entering a brave new world, aggressive biotech firms are exploiting untapped markets through innovation. Vertex Pharmaceuticals is leading the charge. Best known for its cystic fibrosis drugs that can treat 95% of all people living with the illness, Vertex is working on cutting-edge therapies, including mRNA treatments developed with Moderna. Second quarter 2025 sales reached $2.96 billion, up 12% year-over-year, with full-year guidance raised to a high end of $12 billion. Building on its profitable core and breakthrough partnerships, Vertex is positioned to capture future demand. Shares could climb to $520 within 18 months, a gain of more than 30% gain from current levels. The author, John D. Markman, is president of Markman Capital Insight and editor of Digital Creators and Consumers. And the second small article here is called The Vault, Individual Innovation. Axsome Therapeutics founder Harriet Tabuteau has more than 400 patents, including for Auvility, a depression drug that his own company licensed from him for about $9 million last year. But inventive businessmen are not a new thing. Back in 1979, Forbes visited the chaotic Midtown Manhattan office of Robert Lester, an independent inventor who had big ideas for everything from hidden windshield wipers to an imaging typewriter to an ultrasonic locating system, something like an early Apple AirTag. Lester did quite well for himself, but unlike Tabuteau, never really struck it big. And there's a quote here from Robert Lester from Forbes, December 10th, 1979. "It's not easy being a full-time independent inventor in this age of technology. The days of lucrative tinkering in the garage Henry Ford style are all but over." Lester figures there can't be more than 100 men like him left in the country. But Lester, who holds around 50 U.S. patents, has a few more pending, isn't complaining. "He makes a comfortable living. I have my bad years and my good years, but I live out with all the millionaires in Manhasset. I manage never to earn less than $50,000 a year, which in today's money would be $210,000. Here's the quote. "To be very honest with you, manufacturing never really interested me. When I finish an invention, even before I finish writing the patent application, I'm not interested in it anymore. I'm interested in new things." Our next article here is called Zone Offense by John Hyatt. With a combination of cash incentives, stock options, and aggressive financial engineering, AutoZone made a billionaire out of its founder and millionaires of thousands of its employees. But can one of the top stocks of the last three decades keep it up in the face of new rivals and fewer gearheads? Phil Danielle was working for a competing auto parts chain when AutoZone entered the Jacksonville, Florida market in 1986. Danielle had worked in car stores since high school, paying his way through college by stocking shelves. He joined AutoZone in 1993 as a store manager in training before being given his own store after a few months, the first of 10 titles in three decades. "I'm not a phenomenon. If you look at our leadership team, many of our VPs started out in an hourly role at a store," says Danielle, 56, who is now CEO of AutoZone. Today, AutoZone, known for its universal "Get in the Zone, AutoZone" radio jingle, employs 126,000 people with over 6,500 stores in the U.S. and another 1,000 in Mexico and Brazil. The retailer sells everything from motor oil and upholstery cleaner to specialized car parts for nearly every make and model. With $18.5 billion in sales last year, it's worth about $7 billion. In the last 20 years, its shares have returned an average of 21% annually, trouncing the S&P 500's 11% average return, including dividends reinvested over the same period. AutoZone has generated nine-figure-plus windfalls for its original private equity sponsor, KKR, hedge fund billionaire Eddie Lampert, and its founder, Pitt Hyde, who stepped down as CEO in 1996. "I wish I had never diversified. That was a huge mistake," jokes Hyde, 82, who's worth around $2 billion today. He sold most of his AutoZone stock back in the 1990s. Had he kept it, he'd be worth over $10 billion. But it's not just AutoZone's investors and top brass who have gotten rich, and that is the company's real secret sauce. With a compensation system built around stock options, the retailer has made many of its rank and file wealthy beyond their wildest dreams. More than 4,000 AutoZone employees, including many like Danielle, who began as hourly employees or store managers in the 1980s and 90s, have become millionaires from their AutoZone stock, Hyde says. Our compensation structure is one of the key elements of our success, says Bill Rhodes, chair of the board since 2007 and AutoZone CEO and president from 2005 to 2023. There are very, very few companies that are still 100% stock options in their long-term incentives. That's what we are with our senior leadership team. Following a 2006 accounting rule change requiring companies to record options as expenses on their income statement, many S&P 500 companies have favored compensation packages with restricted and performance-based stock units, grants of stock with no exercise price, over stock options, the right to buy a stock at the price on the date it was awarded. But AutoZone stayed the course and has granted options rewards to eligible employees every year for the past 25 years, equal to 0.9% of its total shares outstanding. Executives can also elect to take 25% of their annual compensation in AutoZone stock. Our people want the risk. They want the leverage that comes with stock options, says Rhodes, who has netted over $500 million exercising options and selling the stock before taxes. As it's grown, AutoZone has restricted eligibility of stock options awards to about 400 higher-level employees, down from over 38,000 in the late 90s. Today, store managers who drive AutoZone's retail sales are incentivized with cash bonuses based on sales quotas. Store hands are supposed to ask people if they need help within 30 seconds of a customer walking into the store. They perform routine maintenance, like changing batteries or installing wipers, at no cost and on site. Hit your targets and drive sales, and you'll be compensated for it. Or, better yet, one day you may end up in corporate, which means stock options whose value only seems to go up. Employees can also buy up to $15,000 in AutoZone stock annually at a 15% discount to market price, through an employee stock purchase plan. The idea is to keep the sales force aligned, invested in AutoZone's future, and motivated to sell, sell, sell. At corporate, the mantra has been buy, buy, buy back its own stock. AutoZone has purchased $38 billion of its shares since 1998 through May 2025, reducing its outstanding share count by over 90% from 152 million to 16.7 million as of June. 1998 is also when it started limiting stock options. The company has bought back more shares over time, a total of 155.5 million, than it originally had outstanding, 152 million. How is that mathematically possible? It's because of the dilution from all of those stock options the company awards. The model has proven it durable, thanks to AutoZone's earnings moving in only one direction. Since 1987, revenue has increased every year, growing 11.5% annually, while operating income, $3.3 billion last year, and net income, $2.6 billion last year, have increased in all but 3 years. The company has been disciplined in its capital expenditure, opting for slow and steady earnings growth over breakneck expansion. It helps that the auto parts industry cruises through recessions as cash-strapped drivers opt to fix rather than replace their cars. If you put financial engineering on top of a bad business, you're just going to go out of business faster, Rhodes says. If you have a really good business, putting financial engineering on top of that can optimize performance, or, as I sometimes like to say, put it on steroids. But to keep its well-oiled machine chugging, AutoZone needs to keep growing. It holds $9 billion in long-term debt on which it must pay interest, $450 million last year, and it has accelerated share repurchases, averaging $3.6 billion in annual share buybacks from 2021 through 2024, compared to an average of $1.2 billion the previous decade. Its biggest headaches are macro headwinds. For one, its beloved DIY customer, the fixer-up guy who comes into the local AutoZone store to be charmed by a motivated salesman, is a bit of a dying breed, says Philip Blee, a consumer equity analyst at William Blair. In 1990, over half of Americans identified as car DIYers, but today DIYers account for only a fifth of the total $400 billion automotive aftermarket. Not only have parts have gotten more expensive, cutting into the value proposition, but cars have become harder to repair as they have become more complex and computerized. AutoZone also faces growing competition for the die-hard DIYers from the likes of Walmart, Costco, and Amazon. The big box retailers are some of the near-term threats, Blee says. AutoZone increasingly sells directly to repair shops, both independents and national chains, a market that now counts for an estimated 75% of the entire industry and 90% of its growth, according to William Blair. In this space, where customer service is less about face-to-face salesmanship and more about delivering parts faster than anyone else, its biggest rival, O'Reilly Auto Parts, has raced ahead, generating $7.8 billion last year from commercial sales compared to AutoZone's $5.9 billion. Danielle sees that not as a failure, but as an opportunity. He says AutoZone is beefing up its distribution network with new mega hubs that can hold over 100,000 unique car parts for nearly any vehicle, from your sister's new Toyota Camry to your neighbor's beat-up Chevy Corvette. We've worked on our strategy of expanding our supply chain. We've run it too tight before, says the CEO, who ran the commercial business from 2015 to 2021. And AutoZone isn't loosening its grip on DIYers. It's just looking for them in different places. The chain plans to open 500 new stores in 2028, up from the 190 it has averaged the last 5 years, 200 of them in Mexico and Brazil. AutoZone is nothing if not adaptable. Joseph Pitt Hyde III founded the company, then called Auto Shack, in 1979 after seeing the writing on the wall for his family business, Memphis, Tennessee-based Malone & Hyde, which sold groceries to independent mom-and-pop grocery stores and small chains in the South. He watched as Walmart, on whose board he sat from 1978 to 1983, gobbled up his market share. His idea was to take Walmart's retailer-distributor model, combine it with a shiny supermarket aesthetic, and bring it to smaller industry with fatter margins. Auto Parts, which combined fixed prices, inelastic demand, and no clear national brand, struck him as a clear winner. He researched the industry for a year before opening his first store in Forest City, Arkansas. Within 5 years, he had 170 stores. I learned so much from Sam Walton about his whole productivity cycle, Hyde recalls. He was growing rapidly, and as he leveraged his central overhead, he gained buying power. Rather than putting it on the bottom line, he reflected it in lower prices. And that's what we instituted at AutoZone. Clear-eyed about the trajectory of his two businesses' futures, Hyde took Malone & Hyde private with KKR in 1984 and spun out AutoZone, renamed after a lawsuit by Radio Shack, 2 years later. It was really modeled after Walmart. Low prices, great customer service, a good old-fashioned way of doing things, says George Roberts, KKR's billionaire co-founder, which made $2.3 billion on its AutoZone stake. Hyde stepped down as CEO and board chair in 1996 after being diagnosed with prostate cancer. Hedge fund billionaire Eddie Lampert, best known for merging Sears with Kmart, built a 30% stake in AutoZone between 1998 and 2001 and came to its board with ideas, including the share buyback program. He pitched for us to change our capital allocation, recalls Rhodes, who was then SVP of finance. We've continued to use that over the years, and it's gotten bigger and bigger. AutoZone's smartest bet was its $57 million, or $118 million in today's dollars, acquisition in 1996 of vehicle diagnostics database AllData, which employees use constantly to identify the exact car part any given customer needs and how much it'll cost. As AutoZone enters its next chapter, Danielle is determined to uphold what made it so successful and so rewarding. Our culture has modified and morphed a little bit, but the primary tenets are the same, he says. If you're committed to the industry and committed to the culture, you can do anything at this company. If AutoZone can keep its stock market magic alive and its flock faithful, he might just be right. There's a final thought quote here. Wealth is like muck, not good unless it be spread. That's by Francis Bacon. There's a few more little small articles. This one is a How to Play It by John Buckingham. While riches have amassed for auto parts sellers like AutoZone and electric vehicle king Tesla has found investor fancy as a technology play, the traditional car makers themselves offer tremendous total return potential in a stock market trading at all-time highs. After all, General Motors, Honda Motor, and Volkswagen have ridden a decent sales environment to solid profits in recent years, fueling significant investment in electric vehicles to go along with healthy internal combustion engine businesses. While I'm not looking for massive increases in their bottom lines, I think consistently robust net income should be rewarded with higher forward price-to-earnings ratios than the current single-digit levels, especially as GM has also been buying back a truckload of stock, Honda has a lucrative motorcycle business, and Volkswagen holds a sizable ownership stake in Porsche. All three also reward shareholders with dividend payouts. John Buckingham, the author of this, is editor of The Prudent Speculator. In another small listicle called View It Yourself, DIYers might still grab supplies from the local Home Depot or AutoZone, but the how-to guide went online long ago. Here's a handful of hands-on influencers with seven-figure followings on YouTube. Number one is Chris Fix, followers 10.8 million. Advice on how to do a brake job, replace a transmission, or restore your car's headlights using toothpaste. Karina Garcia, 9 million. The Gen Z popular Queen of Slime has recipes for making ultra-clear slime, thick and glossy slime, even slime in bulk. Dad, how do I? 5.3 million. Rob Kenny's father abandoned him at age 14. Now, he posts tutorials on topics like how to tie a tie, shave, or start a campfire. Home Reno Vision DIY, 3.8 million. Contractor Jeff Thorman explains how to do everything from painting a wall to finishing an entire basement. And Kip K, 2.5 million. An early YouTuber, he joined before Google bought the site in 2006, with gadget hacks such as how to charge your phone with a flashlight or make a Wi-Fi signal booster with a beer can. Okay, our next article here is How to Stalk a Billionaire by William Baldwin. Joe Bauernfrohn's fund makes some nice money tagging along behind fat cats like Rupert Murdoch and Vincent Bolloré. In the City of London's investment trust business, dog eats dog. Thus it is that Daniel Loeb, activist investor who shakes up torpid corporate managements, found himself under attack from another activist. Following a shareholder vote on August 14th, Loeb pulled off a contentious merger of his London-listed trust with an offshore insurance company that he also controls. But he does not emerge from the fight unscathed. He had to cough up more cash to dissident shareholders than he wanted. Leader of the dissidents, Joe Bauernfrohn, a soft-spoken British money manager who has a curious specialty. He tracks billionaires, or rather their holding companies. His vehicle is AVI Global Trust, a $1.6 billion UK investment company. This venerable closed-end, inception date, 1889, was created to speculate in Africa's diamond-rich Transvaal region, but in recent decades has redefined itself as a value player. AVI buys shares of companies trading at discounts to their liquidating value. A few of these are asset-rich operating businesses, not hard to find in Japan. The majority are either other investment companies or holding companies controlled by wealthy families. Bauer Fund's targets have included entities controlled by the Agnelli family of Italy, whose wealth comes from Fiat and Ferrari, Leon Black, Apollo, the D. Etherian family in Belgium, Safe Light Autoglass, France's Vincent Bolloré, Vivendi, and Bernard Arnault, LVMH, Britain's Keswick family, Jardine Matheson, and the Murdochs, News Corporation. Most people see News Corp as a media company. AVI characterizes it as a holding company, its juiciest holdings being the Wall Street Journal and a 61% stake in REA, an Australian real estate firm. Bauer Fund says News Corp is trading at 41% discount to its liquidating value. Bargain hunting pays off. Over the 40 years since the portfolio manager Asset Value Investors got the contract to manage what was then called British Empire Trust, the trust has delivered an 11.8% compound annual return in pounds, 2.4 percentage points better than that of ACWI Global Stock Index. A minority shareholder's hope is that the insiders controlling a publicly trading entity will, perhaps after some prodding, do something to narrow that discount. They might buy in shares, simply a complex corporate structure in a way to make the publicly traded portion more attractive, or go all out with a liquidation that erases the discount. We can't force these families to do what they don't want to do, Bauer Freund says. The ones that are interested in to us not only have acted in the interest of their families, but haven't abused minority shareholders. Bauer Freund, 53, used to work on the other side of the fence. He started out analyzing real estate for a wealthy company that had a collection of private assets and also a publicly traded property company. In time, the family went entirely private by buying out public investors. Bauer Freund went off to the London Business School for a master's degree with a thesis on asset plays. He joined AVI in 2002 and is now its chief investment officer and largest shareholder. Holding companies can get messy, blending stakes in publicly traded and privately held enterprises. Prime example, the empire presided over the 73-year-old Vincent Bolloré. Bolloré's collection of corporations and cross-holdings is dizzyingly complex, but here's the short version. Bolloré SE is a conglomerate with ventures in media, logistics, and telecom. It owns shares in Universal Music Group, the largest publisher of music, and shares in Vivendi, which was once a water utility, but after years of deal-making has turned into a de facto investment trust. Vivendi owns shares in UMG, plus shares of other publicly traded corporations. Both Bolloré and Vivendi are trading at handsome discounts to the liquidating values, Bauer Freund says. The AVI Trust has stakes in each. Why don't other people see value? Bauer Freund's answer? For many investors, this kind of company is just uninvestable, either because they're lazy, or it's too complex, or it doesn't fit neatly into the way people think about the world. Why does a dealmaker tolerate holding companies and their pesky minority shareholders? Cross-shareholdings between various listed and unlisted holding companies, in effect, allow him to control a greater pool of assets with a limited amount of capital, Bauer Freund says. It's the playbook that many European families have used over the years in order to expand their wealth. Another motivation could be tax avoidance. A depressed price on a holding company would presumably be helpful on an estate or wealth tax filing. In the course of assembling a luxury goods empire and becoming, at times, the wealthiest person on the planet, Bernard Arnault has allowed a stray 2% piece of a holding company called Christian Dior to remain in public hands. Dior, whose sole activity is sitting on shares in widely held LVMH, trades at an 18% discount to the value of its net assets. The AVI Trust owns some of Dior's tiny float. Bauernfreund is betting on an eventual narrowing of the discount, perhaps in collapse of the holding company structure. When things work out, a minority shareholder tagging along behind a poobah gets a double-sided gain. The discount narrows at the same time the underlying asset performs well. It is reasonable to bet on the latter, since billionaires didn't get where they are by making bad investments. Vincent Bolloré started out in the end zone, in 1981 assuming control, from creditor banks of a financially troubled family enterprise for the sum of 1 franc and a promise to repay its debts. Now Forbes rates his family's worth at $10.4 billion. He gets an A-plus for performance. What about the discount? In July, France's Autorite des Marchés Financiers decreed that Bolloré SE's entanglement with Vivendi is such that it must offer to buy up all public shares of the entity at a yet-to-be-determined fair price. Bolloré is appealing that judgment, but the crackdown was enough to send Vivendi's share price up 14%. The contretemps with Loeb ended with a modest win for outside investors. Although based in New York, Loeb set up a London-listed investment trust, Third Point Investors, to gather additional capital. Third Point's sole asset was a stake in another Loeb entity, an offshore fund that is a private corporation but does disclose a list of its stock positions, recently totaling $7.6 billion. Falling out of favor, the listed Third Point fund sank to 31% discount to its net asset value. Loeb decided to merge it with a new entity, a reinsurance company, offshore of course, that he set up. The new company hasn't done much, but he has, per its pitch to investors, a grand plan to coin money by raising capital via the sale of fixed-rate annuities and lending it at higher rates in the mortgage and junk bond markets. As originally proposed, the merger would allow investors in the London fund to get cash for a portion of their shares while being obliged to take shares in the insurance venture for the rest. AVI, holding shares in the London fund, raised a stink. The change from investment trust to insurer was so radical that shareholders deserved the option to cash out at full asset value, AVI said, and it urged them to vote against the merger. AVI lost the vote but extracted from Loeb an 81% boost in the cash distribution. A Loeb staffer argues that an independent board blessed the transaction. AVI Global has stakes in 9 closed-end funds that, like Third Point, trade at a discount if pushed into liquidation. But AVI Global is itself a closed-end trading at a discount. In 2001, a New York hedge fund grabbed a 16% stake and demanded a seat on the board. The insiders narrowly won a shareholder vote, but the threat of a forced liquidation never went away. To stay in good favor with shareholders, and with the independent board of the trust, which could fire AVI and hire a new portfolio manager, AVI Global periodically purchases its own shares, keeping the discount to a recent 7%. The sacrificial buys shrink the asset base on which AVI earns a 0.7% annual fee, but lessen the risk of a more drastic outcome. Says a differential Bauernfreund, as long as the shareholders are happy with AVI, then the board would probably feel compelled to keep renewing the management agreement. Who better than a predator to know how easy it is to become the prey? There's a final thought quote here. It does not take a majority to prevail, but rather an irate, tireless minority. And that's Samuel Adams who said that. There's a small mini article here called Activism Light. The Tokyo market has a wealth of companies with real estate and other assets worth almost as much as their market capitalization, Joe Bauernfreund says. In effect, you're getting an operating business for a low multiple, sometimes a zero multiple, of its profits. But outsiders must be patient when nudging management toward an asset sale or share buyback. Being a shareholder activist against the likes of Dan Loeb has lessons for operating in Japan, he says. But we have to approach it very differently. To be an aggressive, hostile activist in Japan is to ask for failure. He expects success with Mitsubishi Logistics and Roto Pharmaceutical. Another small article here, How to Play It by William Baldwin. Asset Value Investors, which manages a trust that started out in African mortgages, has recently been paying a lot more attention to the other side of the globe. Japan is not a bad place to prospect. In its recent 7-year forecast, institutional money manager GMO put small company Japanese value stocks ahead of all other asset classes. Adventurous investors whose brokers allow the purchase of overseas closed-end funds should look at AVI Japan Opportunity Trust. Expense ratio, 1.5%, 5-year average annual return on the net asset value, 14%. A tamer and cheaper option is the U.S.-registered iShares MSCI Japan Small Cap ETF. Expense, 0.5%, 5-year annualized return, 7%. William Baldwin is a Forbes Investment Strategies columnist. Now it's time for the cover profile. This article is called Chicken Scratch. No one believed in Todd Graves' idea for a campus outpost serving only chicken fingers. Now, Raising Cane's is one of America's hottest fast food chains, and its details-obsessed founder is America's richest restaurateur, worth $22 billion. This article is by Chase Peterson Withorn. To start off, I'm going to read some of the small little articles before I get into the big one. There's a small one here that says, working like a dog. Pictured on Graves' lap, Raising Cane, died 1998, was the chain's unofficial mascot. Graves' second yellow lab, Raising Cane II, who died in 2016, was a therapy dog who toured hospitals. Raising Cane III, born 2017, promotes the brand through social media cameos with gymnast Livy Dune and NFL star Jaden Daniels. She's the perfect commercial dog, Graves says. And another one over here, it says, the $400,000 treehouse. It's fun to have things that are magical, says Todd Graves, standing near a flat-screen TV in the living room of his backyard treehouse in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. A fan of the Animal Planet series Treehouse Masters, Graves had the show build him a tree home fit for a billionaire in 2015. His three-level airy, wrapped around a 100-foot live oak, boasts a well-stocked bar, a spacious bedroom, and a functioning half-bath. The pine ceiling uses reclaimed wood from an old sewing factory. The bar and an ornate stained glass window were salvaged from New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. A 70-foot swinging bridge connects the 400-square-foot living quarters to a lakefront viewing platform overlooking LSU's campus. Graves paid around $400,000 for the treehouse, about as much as typical Americans spend on their actual home, and uses it to host the likes of rapper Nelly, NFL star Ja'Marr Chase, and basketball great Shaquille O'Neal, who was inspired to build his own speakeasy-themed treehouse in Georgia. I like things with great stories behind them, says Graves, who also owns a 66-million-year-old Triceratops skeleton, Harrison Ford's Raiders of the Lost Ark jacket, and Elvis Presley's sunglasses. I just won a bid on one of Napoleon's hats today, he says. It keeps me dreaming, man. Okay, and here's the actual start of the article. Todd Graves is in tour guide mode. He begins at a small restaurant a block from Louisiana State University. The summer sun is baking the blacktop as Graves marched through the drive-thru, heading for the menu board he personally erected 29 years ago. I built this structure, he says, naming the local lumber yard that sold him the wood. He points out the 20-foot mural he had painted on the side of the building. He showcases the neon chicken fingers light he designed at a Baton Rouge sign shop. Inside the cramped eatery, we make stops at the portrait of his dog he hung on the wall, the disco ball he installed, and the spot he carved his name into a table. Let me show you the back, he says, speeding through the kitchen to a closet-sized office where he built himself a small desk to keep the books. I spent so much time in here counting the tills. Near the front door, a 20-something customer pulls Graves aside to pitch an idea for a drive-through dog treat chain. Graves suggests the man start smaller, with a trailer or maybe an event booth, exactly the sort of wise, cautious advice he would have flatly ignored at that age. At 22, Todd Graves was 100% certain a spot serving only chicken fingers would be a hit with LSU students, even if the banks thought he was a dumb kid with a bad idea. He had a childish menu, no management experience, no money. When you're an entrepreneur and you believe in something to your core, you use every no and every it's not going to work as fuel, he says. Now, a youthful 53 with a head of graying dark brown hair and a Louisiana bayou drawl. It's the best thing that can happen to you. 3 decades after scraping together the cash to open his first restaurant, Graves has put up more than 900 Raising Cane's Chicken Fingers locations in 42 states. It's one of America's biggest chains, and one of the quickest growing, currently adding around 125 stores a year. Graves can't open them fast enough. Sales hit $5.1 billion last year, or a staggering $6.6 million per store, second only to Chick-fil-A, $7.5 million, and more than double that of all but 6 major chains. A typical fast food joint is lucky to break $2 million. It's just incredible, says restaurant consultant John Gordon. No one runs a fast food business quite like Graves. While most chains offer expansive menus to cater to every taste and shuffle in movie tie-ins or limited-time combos to drive interest, Graves' menu hasn't grown up one bit. Raising Cane's serves just 5 food items: chicken fingers, crinkle fries, coleslaw, Texas toast, and a single dipping sauce. No dessert, forget about salad. He hasn't allowed a new item since 2007, which was lemonade. Friends, family, bankers, and customers have often suggested Graves add more to the mix. He's heard it 100,000 times, maybe more. I'll look into that, he politely tells them, but he knows he won't. We do one thing, chicken fingers, and we do it better than anybody else, he says, laying out his core philosophy. If you try to be all these things to all people, you won't be special. Those around him tend to use terms like detail-oriented, passionate, control freak. I'm extremely into the details, says Graves, carefully styled his sweltering afternoon in a jet black polo, light wash jeans, and crisp white sneakers. Many of his competitors are selling out to Wall Street firms, including the billionaires behind Subway, sold to Roark Capital for $9 billion plus, Jersey Mike's Subs, Blackstone, an $8 billion valuation, including debt, and Cane's competitor Zaxby's, Goldman Sachs, a nearly $2 billion valuation. Graves can't imagine ever selling. He still writes many of Raising Cane's marketing campaigns. He personally reviews the kids' meals toys. He oversees every decoration it nailed to every restaurant wall. His obsession has paid off. Graves is now America's richest restaurateur, worth $22 billion, thanks to his 92% stake in the business. That places him at number 46 on this year's Forbes 400 list, in the financial league of Jerry Jones and Rupert Murdoch. I'm living a dream, he says, extending the tour to his nearby 5,000-square-foot guest house that he lends to his NFL star buddies and the $400,000 treehouse where he hangs out with celebrity superfans. I'm living an absolute dream. The unassuming two-story building around the corner from the first Cane store is a journey back in time. Inside a second-floor apartment, a Panasonic VHS player flanks an old TV set. Boxy beige computers and floppy disks sit atop cheap desks. A case of Dixie beer is displayed on the counter. The scene has been faithfully recreated by Graves to look just as it did in the 1990s, when he moved into the apartment and, as he expanded, turned it into a makeshift headquarters, pushing his bed into a corner, where it remains, to make way for more desks. Graves bought the building in 2016 and now brings restaurant managers and corporate staff through for a lesson in brand history and staying scrappy. History is important to keep in your company, he says. This is where we started. This is our roots. Graves is a natural storyteller. The son of an extended auto warranty salesman who spent a couple seasons in the NFL as a New Orleans Saint tackle long before it paid any real money, Graves was the kid running a lemonade stand, hiring friends to join his lawn service, and painting house numbers on curbs, one-upping the competition by adding a small pineapple. He wrote a puppet TV show called The Adventures of Doozy Haha and His Brothers and studied telecommunications at the University of Georgia, daydreaming of moving to Hollywood and pushing a broom to get his foot in the door at a movie studio. But the urge to start his own business, it seemed more tangible, won out. Fast food was the obvious choice. Graves had worked restaurant jobs since high school and regularly spent hours making gumbo with his mother. Food just symbolized love for me, he recalls. By the 1990s, chicken was overtaking beef in the American diet, and boneless strips were becoming popular at national chains like TGI Fridays and Applebee's. Then there was Guthrie's, a small Alabama-based chain that had been expanding across college campuses, including the University of Georgia, where Graves dished out chicken fingers and crinkle fries to fellow college kids. He told Greg Sylvie, a childhood buddy studying at LSU, that they should open their own version. Sylvie had to write a business plan for a class, so the duo submitted their chicken finger concept, mapping out everything from the cost of aprons to the brand of toilet paper they'd buy. The professor gave them a B-. He said the plan was good, but the concept is flawed, Graves recalls. The major chains were expanding their menus and going healthier. They needed to offer more options. Graves wasn't convinced. I knew well enough to know that at my favorite restaurants, I order the same thing every single time. So he and Sylvie made a blood pact that they'd go through with it, solemnizing their vow by scratching their wrists with an old chicken claw they had found. They hit Office Depot, bought two cheap briefcases they thought would look professional, then hit the banks. One after another declined, either not believing in the restaurant, the pair's ability to run it, or both. It was not a pleasant experience, Sylvie says. To stack cash fast, Graves found work as a boilermaker in Los Angeles, manning welding equipment and blowtorches at oil refineries. When he heard the real money was in Alaska, commercial sockeye salmon fishing in Bristol Bay, he and Sylvie flew north. They pitched a tent on the side of the highway, eventually making their way to the docks and talking their way onto a couple vessels. We rammed boats, boats rammed us. We were catching so much fish, Graves remembers. National Geographic's flying planes over, medical helicopters are coming in, you're hearing on the radio that somebody died. I wasn't too happy about the salmon fishing, says Gay Graves, Todd's mother, but he always called home. When the duo returned to Baton Rouge about a year later, $50,000 in hard-won savings in hand, they looked a lot more creditworthy. Their cash, $90,000 from a few local investors, and a $50,000 Small Business Administration loan was enough to lease the space just off LSU's North Gates. They got to work installing everything from the menu board to the wood-paneled walls to the bathroom plumbing themselves to save money. They tooled around the South in a U-Haul scooping up used kitchen equipment and restaurant booths on the cheap. Graves worked with local food suppliers to essentially steal Guthrie's menu, but tweak it to his liking. Guthrie's slightly thicker crinkle fries have, quote, too much inner softness of the potato, he says, while his competitor's slightly thinner Texas toast is, quote, not as dense as he'd prefer. While scrambling to open the restaurant, he connected with Gwen, now his wife of 25 years, who was running a nearby McDonald's franchise, bonding with her over such conversation starters as, how do you salt your fries? Graves and Sylvie almost called their chicken joint Sockeyes in honor of their salmon fishing days until a friend wisely suggested naming it after Graves' dog, a yellow Labrador named Raising Cain, an intentional misspelling of the biblically inspired idiom that means to cause a ruckus. Raising Cain III, his third yellow lab and the chain's current mascot, has 100,000 Instagram followers. The first Raising Cane's opened in August of 1996, with Graves, Sylvie, and a crew of eight manning the registers and fryers. It made a $30 profit the first month and just kept going. 6 months in, Graves set about convincing his SBA lender to finance a second location near a strip mall on a quieter stretch just south of LSU's campus, this one with a drive-thru. We started getting different customers, he says. T-ball teams on Sunday, mom and dad coming home from work, business people during lunch. Sylvie, tired of the 100-hour weeks and ready to ditch the kitchen for an MBA in the Web 1.0 boom in Silicon Valley, soon wanted out. In 1999, Graves paid him a six-figure sum and agreed to take his name off the lease and bank liabilities. A great return for a 27-year-old for just a few years' work. Then again, Sylvie's stake would now be worth north of $10 billion. Sylvie, who remains friends with Graves, later rejoined Keynes as an exec for a half dozen years and owns a tiny stake of less than 0.5% today. It's always easy to have hindsight, says Sylvie, now the CFO, of CloudCover, a Louisiana-based IT service firm. There was a level of risk that no matter how many times I replay it, I know I wouldn't have done it. It's like you're always putting on black on the roulette table. Graves kept gambling on six more locations by 2000 and 24 by 2004. I leveraged the heck out of that business, he said. I had a big risk tolerance. A typical maneuver to finance a new location, raising subordinate debt from private investors at a 15% rate, then borrowing the rest from community banks that would treat the debt as equity, effectively financing 100%. It's not a smart way to grow, he says now. When Hurricane Katrina hit in August of 2005, it knocked 21 of his 28 stores offline, nearly costing him the business. He hustled to keep lenders at bay and vowed to never put the company in that position again. Okay, that's all the time we have for today. I'll have to finish that one out next time. This has been Brooke Heiler with Money Talk. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.